Baby, if you've ever wondered whatever became of me, I'm living on the air in Cincinnati, Cincinnati WKRP. Got kind of tired packing and unpacking, town to town, up and down the dial. Maybe you and me were never meant to be, but baby, think of me once in a while. I'm at WKRP in Cincinnati. I was born in Cincinnati, but that's not why I sang that song. I don't actually remember a radio station called WKRP. There was a WKRC, pretty close, I guess, just one letter off. TV show WKRP in Cincinnati was out in 1978, and that's just 1 year after the big fire at the Beverly Hills Supper Club, which is just across the Ohio River from Cincinnati. And in this fifth Thursday in June 2016, the New American Dream Radio Show is going to focus on that fire. And we have as a guest David Brock, who was a busboy there on that fateful night. He's been researching it, trying to expose what really happened pretty much nonstop for the rest of his life. We're honored to have him join us tonight to tell you about it. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on listener-supported Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Remember to stop by the network and throw them a donation to keep things going. It's a great bunch of people. They keep two streams of audio going out just about all day, every day. Lots of great shows at freedomslips.com. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palaszczuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight, we welcome special guest Frank Cordero and, as you said, David Brock. And so tonight we're gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Des Moines, in northern Minnesota, in Fort Lauderdale, in Cincinnati, and wherever you are. My recommended list for this week is, there's a lot out there, a lot of information available to find out the truth. And my recommended list includes, number one, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, entitled Hillary Clinton, the CIA, the Mob. Number two, it's also on the Fetzer website, Robert Faurisson risks jail for 60-word summary of his research. This is regarding the Holocaust and World War II history. Also recommended, a Fetzer two-part series, The Myth of German Villainy. Find it on YouTube, the Media Broadcasting Center. Also recommended, Len Osanek and Black Op Radio interview with author William Pepper regarding his latest book, The Plot to Kill King. Find it in the Black Op Radio archives. Also available are two recent Jill Stein interviews, one with CNN and another with Redacted Tonight. Also go to Memory Hole blog and find an open letter by Robert David Steele to the FBI director on indicting Hillary Clinton and telling the truth about Orlando. Number seven, the same progressive. Find her on YouTube, most recently talking about election fraud. And as always recommended, False Flag Weekly News. Find it on YouTube. So to repeat, it's jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, Hillary Clinton, the CIA, the Mob. Also on Fetzer, Robert Faurisson. Also recommended the two-part series, The Myth of German Villainy. Also recommended Len Osanek and Black Op Radio talking to William Pepper. You won't want to miss that. Also available are two recent Jill Stein interviews, one with CNN and the other with Redacted Tonight. And we can only hope that there's enough time left for Jill Stein to gather momentum. She would be an actual president, an actual real president, someone we could be proud of. Also, go to Memory Hole blog and find an open letter by Robert David Steele to the FBI director on indicting Hillary Clinton and telling the truth about Orlando. Number 7, the same progressive. Find her on YouTube. Most recently talking about election fraud. And as always, recommended False Flag Weekly News. Find it on YouTube. And back to you, Chuck.
And now, we bring you the Daniel Berrigan, Sitting Bull, Robert Kennedy, Emma Goldman, Joe Bagin, L.D. Barkley, Lyman Lemonisser, Target and Walmart, 4th of July card collection, a card designed with you in mind. Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of the charnel house, who could not so help us God do otherwise. For we are sick at heart, our hearts give us no rest for thinking of the land of burning children. As Dan Berrigan, part of a statement at trial for Catonsville 9. If we must die, we die defending our rights. City Bull. A revolution is coming. A revolution which would be peaceful if we are wise enough. Compassionate if we care enough. Successful if we're fortunate enough. But a revolution is coming whether we will it or not. We can affect its character. We cannot alter its inevitability. Robert F. Kennedy. People have only as much liberty as they have the intelligence to want and the courage to take. Emma Goldman. In the old days, class warfare was between the rich and the poor, and that's the kind of class war I can sink my teeth into. Joe Badgett. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to the situation which threatens the lives of not only us, but every one of you. L.D. Barkley, a leader of the Attica Rebellion, killed when guards and police stormed the prison yard, September 13, 1971, 9:46 a.m. Operation Northwoods was a 1962 plan by the U.S. Department of Defense to stage acts of simulated or real terrorism on U.S. soil and against U.S. interests, and then put the blame of these acts on Cuba in order to generate U.S. public support for military action against the Cuban government of Fidel Castro. The plan was proposed by senior U.S. Department of Defense leaders, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Lewis Lemonisser. As part of the U.S. government's Operation Mongoose anti-Castro initiative, the plan, which was not implemented, called for various false flag actions, including simulated or real state-sponsored acts of terrorism on U.S. and Cuban soil. Codenamed Operation Northwoods, the plan, which had the written approval of the chairman and every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for boats carrying refugees fleeing Cuba to be sunk on the high seas, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit, planes would be hijacked. Using phony evidence, all would be blamed on Castro, thus giving Lemonisser and his cabal the excuse, as well as the public and international backing they needed to launch their war. Among the most elaborate schemes was to create an incident which will demonstrate convincingly that a Cuban aircraft has attacked and shot down a chartered civil airliner en route from the United States to Jamaica, Guatemala, Panama, or Venezuela. The destination would be chosen only to cause the flight plan route to cross Cuba. The passengers could be a group of college students off on a holiday or any grouping of persons with a common interest to support chartering a non-scheduled flight. Lemonisser and the Joint Chiefs worked out a complex deception. An aircraft at Elgin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft belonging to a CIA proprietary organization in the Miami area. At a designated time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with the selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone, a remotely controlled unmanned aircraft. Takeoff times of the drone aircraft from the actual aircraft would be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida. From the rendezvous point, the passenger-carrying aircraft would ascend a minimum altitude and go directly to an auxiliary field at Elgin Air Force Base, where arrangements will have been made to evacuate the passengers and return the aircraft to its original status. The drone aircraft, meanwhile, will continue to fly the pilot flight plan. When over Cuba, the drone will be transmitting on the international distress frequency a Mayday message, stating he's under attack by Cuban mid-aircraft. The transmission will be interrupted by destruction of the aircraft, which will be triggered by a radio signal. This will allow ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, the radio stations in the Western Hemisphere, to tell the U.S. what has happened to the aircraft instead of the U.S. trying to sell the incident.
The Daniel Berrigan, Sitting Bull, Robert Kennedy, Emma Goldman, Joe Badgett, L.D. Barkley, Lyman, Lemnitzer, Target and Walmart, 4th of July card collection, a card designed with you in mind. Our first guest of the evening is David Brock. As Chuck said, David Brock has a story to tell, and he's going to be our guest in all three guest segments tonight, and Chuck is going to get David's interview going right about now.
For tonight's show, we have the same guest on all three segments, David Brock. And he's going to tell us quite a bit about the Beverly Hills Supper Club and the fire that occurred there many years ago. David, welcome to the show. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Chuck. My name is David Brock. I'm originally from Southgate, Kentucky. The place I was employed in 1977, on May 28th, which Memorial Day weekend, was called the Beverly Hills Supper Club. It was in existence from 1936. In 1977, it burnt down that evening and killed 169 people and injured over 200. It was considered the showplace of the nation on the East Coast. It had 2,600 people approximately that night at the club, and had a showroom that held 1,000 people, two large restaurants that held 750 to 1,000, and 21 banquet rooms. And it was loaded that night with people. They were there to see a show with the headline show was named John Davidson. And fire started around 5 to 9 that evening, and by the time we realized what truly had happened and the magnitude of it, people were dying of smoke inhalation in the showroom. And throughout the years, we continued to go through banker boxes of evidence. We've been probably through over 200 banker boxes of all the evidence, the colored photos, black and whites, and it took about 5 years of investigation, or about a dozen of our group that we have together, and we now can prove that the fire was an arson fire.
David, what I'd like you to start with in the first segment here is a little bit more of the background. Who had owned it over the years, and all the things leading up to the actual fire.
That's fine. In 1936, it was owned by, it was at that time called the Beverly Hills Club, Beverly Hills Country Club. It was owned by an organization called the Cleveland Four, which was out of Ohio. And the organization out of Beck is called Boulevard Inc. And they were considered the kingpin guys in the East Coast that ran all the racketeering, gambling, and everything for the East Coast. They owned it from 1936 and operated it and it's illegal gambling for 1961. The gentleman's name is Mo DeLeese. That was the main guy. The gentleman that owned the land with the mob was named Sam Schrader. And they owned about 500 acres of land around the area of Beverly Hills. And in 1961, the Kennedys, Robert Kennedy, and the FBI came in, raided the state of Kentucky in the area called Newport, which is Sin City. They considered Sin City of Newport because there was 33 illegal gambling casinos that was operational in the state of Kentucky. And they came in 1961 and shut all of them down, racketeering. And it sat dormant for 9 years. Then the 4R Corporation, owned by the Schilling family, decided to buy it in 1970. And they were, at that point, rebuilding it, remodeling it, and they opened the facility in 1971 with the lease option to buy from the Cleveland Four. And in 1977 is when the fire happened. It was very lucrative, going over $15 million a year. They had, they considered the showplace of the nation. They would bring the Vegas shows to Newport, Kentucky, and they were basically just running them back and forth, and the Schillings did quite well with it. And then at that time is when the mob decided they would like to have another piece of it, and the Schillings refused to sell it back to them or even become partners. At that time in 1977, they burned them down to prove a point.
Now, there's been a lot of controversy over the years. I hear your description of the events, but there's other people that have said that the Schillings themselves burned it down. There's others that have said it wasn't burned down, it was just an accident. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview of all of those aspects?
Well, I know the place itself was, I was a witness, first of all. I was in the club in 1977 at about 10:30 on a Saturday morning to set up the banquets and the restaurants of that day for the upcoming events for that evening. And I witnessed two gentlemen working in the Zebra Room, and that's where the ignition of the fire started at, when I observed it that night, working in the ceiling of the Zebra Room. And that only held about 30 people. I had no idea who these gentlemen were. I kept coming back into the room, trying to get the room set up for a banquet that needed to be set up by 2 o'clock that day. I was in and out of that room from 11 o'clock to 12:45, and the third time I came in the facility, they started getting agitated with me. I had no idea who they were. They said they were finishing up and come back in about 20 minutes. I walked out of the room, and then I decided, hey, at that point, what's the purpose of them being here? And I went back and asked them what they were doing. And they told me that they were working on the air conditioning system of the room. I had no idea, one, that there was even any air conditioning in the room, or what was the AC unit for that room. So at that point, I basically left it alone. So 2 weeks after the fire, we were up on the site. The Schilling family contacted my parents, asked me to come up and help them clean out what was left of theirs that they can remove. And I'm asking the oldest son, Richard Schilling Sr., what was the purpose of people being in the Zebra Room that they had a fire? And he goes, what are you talking about, Brock? And I said, well, there was two gentlemen working in the ceiling the day of the fire. He goes, oh, no, that was a couple months ago. I said, no, the day of the fire, Mr. Schilling. And he goes, what were they doing? And I said, they were told me that they were working on the air conditioning system. And he goes, well, Brock, we don't have an air conditioning system in that room. There was only two air ducts that came in from another portion of the building into that room. And he goes, well, what were they doing? I said, well, I saw them up above the chandeliers. They had the panels pulled away, and they were working in the wiring and all that. When I saw them, he goes, oh, my God, they got to my dad. I said, what do you mean? He goes, they burned us down. He goes, they've been trying to get to our family for a while, and they got my dad. He goes, we knew it. He goes, but we didn't know who it was. And I said, what should we do? He goes, well, you can tell whoever you have to. He goes, but I'd be careful who I would tell it to. He goes, they just killed 100 and some people. And he goes, you live adjacent to this facility. And he goes, you think they're worried about burning this building down and killing all those people? He goes, they'll kill your family and you too. And I said, you got to be kidding me. He goes, no. And at that point, he made it very clear that he was concerned for my safety as well as my family's.
Now, didn't you say that the Shillings received a pretty specific threat before the fire as well?
They had a meeting in April of that year, 1977. Two suited men, black suit, pinstripe suits, came in and met with Mr. Shilling, Richard Shilling Sr. And the boys were there. They came, and two guys said, hey, these guys want it back. We'd like to have the building back. The business is very lucrative here. And Mr. Shilling said, well, it's not for sale. He goes, I built this from scratch. There's no reason to sell this building. And what we have, he goes, this is a cash cow. He goes, I'm going $15 million a year. Why would I want to get rid of it now? And the guy goes, well, then he goes, well, we can't own it back. And how about us becoming partners? And he goes, well, I got my three sons. I don't need a partner. Plus, I have my chef, my lifelong friend. And we have no desire to get rid of it. He goes, in another month, he goes, I'm having a hernia surgery in May, 1st of May. And when I come back in June, we're going to start doing ground work on building a 250-room suite hotel, a 5,000-seat convention center, and retail shops up here. And the guy said to him, well, if we can't have it or become partners of it, maybe you won't have it no more. And Mr. Shilling said, well, we're not going there. And, you know, some cuss words were thrown back and forth of each other. Then he escorted them out of the building. So, never seen the people again ever again. But that happened the 1st of April, 1977.
Well, pretty scary stuff. All right, David, we're gonna call it an end for the first segment, and in our second segment, we'll be going over the timeline of the fire in somewhat greater detail, and then in our final segment, we'll talk about your investigation and the cover up. And so forth. So, that wraps the first segment, and we look forward to the next one.
Well, I hope that you listeners are all looking forward to the second two segments. I really enjoyed talking with David this morning, and I'm recording this, and I've been helping him to get a book back in print. It's called the Beverly Hills Supper Club. I think it's called the Beverly Hills Supper Club Fire. If you search for David Brock and Beverly Hills Supper Club on Amazon, you will see it. The book's available in a print version and an ebook for the Kindle. And I have read it, and I recommend it.
Chuck, thank you for doing this interview, and thank you to David too for being so devoted to the truth and to find out. And I personally am looking forward to. I haven't heard the interview, and I'm looking forward to finding out what happens. Beverly Hills, to me, I was confused a little bit by the name at first, but the Beverly Hills Supper Club is in Cincinnati. Okay. Thank you.
www.thebeverlyhillsupperclub.com. We'll be right back.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious. They just don't take it hard. You can't take part. You can't even possibly take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears, upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. But unless you're playing,
Revolution Radio of FreedomSlips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
When you call down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
You've got a line coming, and I'll come in with me.
Revolution Radio.
Enjoy your extra big ass fries.
I didn't give me no fries. I got an empty box.
Would you like another?
Extra big ass fries.
I said I didn't get any.
Thank you. Your account has been charged. Your balance is zero. Please
what?
Come back when you can afford to make
no,
purchase.
No, no.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Come
you
on. I'm getting starving.
Thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio. Here at Revolution Radio, we believe in freedom of ideas, freedom of speech, and above all, we believe in freedom of existence and self-reliance. This station is 100% listener-supported, and as a fundraising promotion, I have a kick-ass free gift for a $100 donation. 35,000 feet. 25 years in the freezer. Long-term storable, 54 different varieties. So, if food prices go crazy, Christmas hits the fan, or you just want to spend tons of money every year by creating your own food, like I do, grab our Seed Pack Special. Just look for the banner on the homepage at freedomslips.com. Don't be a statistic. Don't be part of the problem. Be part of the solution. We need to ask humans to start taking care of ourselves and not dependent on the megacorps to provide unhealthy, nasty food. Included in this package is also a DVD with 900 survival and off-grid living documents and an offline home canning how to do everything website all on the DVD. So when you're growing all that food, you know how to can it, store it, preserve it, etc. with all these documents. So thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I hope that you will pick up this package and start learning to be free. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps and freedom is the one seed that needs to be planted.
What are we doing right? It goes in the gun.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information,
If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
If you are a good American, then with all the poking and probing going on in airplanes, trains, ball games, schools, the mall, you might well be asking yourself, am I a terrorist? Well, the Center for American Studies has put together a handy brochure now available in most USA interstate rest areas called Mommy, Am I a Terrorist? A few samples. If you're driving past a policeman in the United States, you might be a terrorist. If your Reader's Digest subscription is expired, you might be a terrorist. If you order a salad, you might be a terrorist. If you are walking down the street, well, you might be a terrorist. If your American flag on your front porch flapping in the spring breeze is not larger than a circus tent, you might be a terrorist. If you're directing by remote control from the portico off the rose garden, a drone airplane that hits the home of a family in a small town in Pakistan and rips their arms and legs from their bodies, their heads from their shoulders, and forever destroys the lives of their extended family, you might be a terrorist.
America will soon end and nature will live. Have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. Some famous last words. Christine Todd Whitman, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, speaking about downtown Manhattan in the days after 9/11. The air is safe to breathe.
Colin Powell at the UN, my colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
Ronald Reagan, approximately 80% of our air pollution stems from hydrocarbons released by vegetation, so let's not go overboard in setting and enforcing tough emission standards for man-made sources.
George W. Bush, the same folks that are bombing innocent people in Iraq were the ones who attacked us in America on September the 11th.
U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, speaking about the millions of deaths caused in Iraq by the sanctions during the Clinton administration, we think it's worth it. Barack Obama, Osama bin Laden has been buried at sea. Jean Kirkpatrick, member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet, on the kidnapping, rape, and murder of American nuns in El Salvador. The nuns were not just nuns. The nuns were political activists. Apollo 11 astronauts at a press conference 3 weeks after they were supposed to have been on the moon. Neil Armstrong, we were never able to see stars without looking through the optics. Michael Collins, I don't remember seeing any. Neil Armstrong's speech at the 25th anniversary of Apollo 11. There are great ideas, undiscovered breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of the truth's protective layers.
Janet Reno on burning children alive at Waco. Our concern was for the children. Ronald Reagan, what we have found in this country, and maybe we're more aware of it now, is one problem we've had, even in the best of times, and that's the people who are sleeping on the grates, and the homeless, who are homeless, you might say, by choice.
Barack Obama, I'm aware that some would question the events of 9/11, but let us be clear, Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people that day.
Larry Silverstein, we've had such terrible loss of life, maybe the smartest thing to do is pull him. And they made that decision to pull him, then we watched the building collapse.
George W. Bush, my fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. every effort will be made to spare the lives of innocent civilians. The campaign will be broad and concerted and will use decisive force. No outcome but victory will be accepted. America's freedom will be defended, and freedom will be brought to others.
America will soon end, and nature will live, had the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. Some famous last words.
Our next guest of the evening is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero is a member of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. He's the founder of the Des Moines Catholic Worker, in fact. And Chuck talked to Frank earlier in the evening, and he's going to get that interview, that talk, that discussion up right about now.
Hello, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
Hey, another week.
Indeed.
So I am on the front steps or the front sidewalk of Bergen House, which of course was the original house we moved into 40 years ago, and I am cleaning the bricks in our sidewalk. You know, the grass keeps growing in these things. It's a perpetual job, eternal. I understand they tell me there are better ways to do it. They tell me you can lay it and the stuff won't grow up and the weeds won't get in the way. And I keep telling people, you don't understand. This is my therapy. So I come out here and clean these bricks. And the street right across on the street in Indiana where I live, the street here is a very lively nightlife. We have there's a large kind of social welfare agency thing in a grocery store with a big parking lot. And at night, and during the day, people are guests, many of them and many, many more hang out here and they're not always, good to each other or into each other. And so this is quite a street in its own right. And our position is that, you know, we don't mind street life. A lot of these people are our guests. What we do is we don't like it when it's violent and when they really are nasty to each other. So that's always been a delicate thing. And the climate on the block, is difficult because a lot of folks are on the streets. And many of them continue to try to sleep on our porch, on our main house, which is problematic. Always causes problems. So we got people sleeping in the yard or taking shits all over the place. That's a problem too. I mean, we don't mind the street life or the nightlife. It's just we always ask people to be nice, and we're not always nice. And hell, we're not available 24/7. So anytime a poor person knocks on my door or your door, it's a failure if we're not there for them. So you may think people at the Catholic Worker are doing their job, but the truth is we miss a lot of opportunities simply because we can't be there all the time. It's a very, very clarion kind of statement about there aren't enough of us doing this work. Because with enough people and love, you can really meet most of these needs. You really can. We just don't direct it that way. So I do these bricks. That's what I do. I do these bricks. Year in, year out, these are the same bricks that were here when Joe DeVia and I started this place 4 years ago this coming August. And so I clear them. And I know I get some of the work done, and then it comes back. That's okay. It's eternal work.
Well, that's... It's good to have something like that to come back to, Frank. And
oh yeah,
I can see where that. Yeah, I can see where it'd be therapy. Yeah.
Oh, it's all therapy after 65. Everything you do, if it isn't therapy enjoyable, that's your problem. This has got to be fun, and it is. It really is. And we're about to celebrate a 40th anniversary. It's going to be high profile, all about the church and reform and women. We're also getting ready to join others and do direct action on a pipeline that's coming through Iowa. And we're doing our August stuff at Offutt Air Force Base, Stratcom. We're doing the stuff. We're in trouble with state and church. You know, I think just this is what life's meant to be with some integrity. out here in the Midwest if you call yourself a Catholic worker.
I was interested in your describing the the nightlife in the area there, and I'm wondering, do people play music for each other?
No, this is a lower level. God bless them. These are our people who are capable of holding down a job.
I understand.
There's a lot of culture. Yeah.
I understand that, but I'm just thinking back at different places where I've seen crowds of people in various circumstances.
Yes.
The times that they got along better were the times when people were playing music. I wonder if there's some way we can encourage people to, give them instruments, or just have somebody go out and start singing and playing. I don't know. Do you think it would help?
Well, you just need to be engaged with people. It's time and energy. So if we had five or six folks who could spend the night out with us and with them on the street, hang out, that's a walking in witness. That's all time consuming. Plus, the music's all great stuff. But on a personal level, you got to have the flesh and the bones doing it. And guys, we will. We are open 5 days a week, and we got a clan of folks who try to keep those doors open for the 50 to 100 people we serve every day. We're open. Plus, the many more we give food to. So it's a battle. Are there ways we can do it better? Like I've been telling you, yes. Could we open more? I mean, we could use this space a lot more. We just don't have enough people. That's all I'm trying to say,
Okay. All right.
I don't know why. It's a great job opportunity. Kingdom stuff.
Well, God bless you, Frank. Glad you're doing what you do.
All right, brother.
See you next time.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Our next guest of the evening, as promised, is the second segment of the David Brock interview, and Chuck is going to get that going right about now.
Okay, now it's time for the second segment with David Brock, and he's going to be telling us in some detail about the Night of the Fire. David, take it away.
Chuck, thanks very much. Once again, I'll reiterate, I came in around 10:30 on Saturday morning, May 28, 1977, and my responsibilities as part out was get all the banquets and the rooms prepared for that evening. We knew we had a banquet that started in the Ziegler Room at 2 o'clock, and the wedding people were going to arrive around 1:30 to get the room set up. And just reminding you that I did see two gentlemen working in the ceiling of the Day of the Fire between 11 and 12:45. I remember them quite well due to the fact one gentleman looked at my father, a 5'8", 220-pound big man, big arms, big hands, and he was balding, and the other one was about 6'3", 200 pounds of sideburns and a mustache, long hair. And they were getting very agitated, and that I would just never forget them as long as I live. Would have no idea, but years moving forward, I would find them 30 years later. But all the banquets that day started between 2 and 7 o'clock that evening. Our preparation takes a lot to get those things together. We had a large party in the Empire Room, about 350 people. We also had a responsibility that evening to go set three banquets up in the showroom that held 1,000 people. We had a party of 80 on the raised level. We had two parties around 35 and 25 down by the pit area around the show, where the main area where the entertainers would play. And they all arrived around 6 o'clock. They were all completed by 8:15, 8:20. We had parties going throughout the facility. Very, very easy night. Everything was just going. There's clockwork is normal. The Saturday night with John Davison show going to start about 9:05. You had entertainers, two comedians, on stage that night around 9 o'clock. Like I said, everything was smooth, very quiet evening, beautiful weather, 80 degrees. And about 9:05, a gentleman by the name of Walter Bailey came to myself, as well as Charlie Coslett, at the main podium of the cabaret room, and said, they called me Brock there. I don't know why, but they always used my last name. He said, Brock, there's a fire down in the Viennese room, and you can see clearly down the hallway. He was excited about what he must have saw, because the Viennese room was down to the left and was unable to see any smoke or anything. And at that point, I said, Walter, what are you talking about? So he ran away. He goes, we got to get this room evacuated. So he went to the back area of the showroom. And at that point, we moved the podium out of the way. I went myself to the back behind myself that led you out into the gardens where the weddings and the chapel was, so we could make sure that the doorways were clear and there was no obstruction to anything that was leading out, so we could evacuate that area. Then I proceeded myself to go up towards the Viennese hallway and the Zebra room and the Empire room, and I made myself into the Empire room, and half of the folks were already exiting out. They came towards myself and asked where they should exit out. I said, the way you're going through the kitchen is fine. I'll take you straight out to the back. We emptied that room out, and at that point I decided it was around 9:00, a little after 9, to head towards the Zebra room. And when I got up to the two sets of steps there for the entranceway of the Zebra room, I could see a busboy. His name was Buddy Bethel. I can see that he's running down the spiral staircase, and I'm screaming at him, no, 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 because I knew what he was going to do. He jumped the rail, kicked both doors in. Once he kicked those doors in, it was a backdraft. It sucked him into the room. You can see into the room itself, the mirrors are exploding off the wall. There were towel mirrors, about 10. There were like smoke mirrors, but they were glued to the wall, probably about 12 inches, you know, in the square. And you can hear them popping right off the wall in the back room. You can see through the black smoke, it was soot, and you can see the red flames coming from the ceiling. And it was crawling up the walls into the spiral staircase up to the crystal rooms. And people were still, they were coming down the steps, evacuating, so we're leaving out the front. We did everything we possibly could to grab the two door handles and try to pull them shut. And it was just couldn't do it. It was a backdraft. It was just so strong. The air was so strong that it was the fresh air was sucking in the bottom of it, and it was pushing it like a freight train up the spiral staircase. Schilling came by, Mr. Schilling, which is Rick Schilling Jr. He said, Brock, stay here. I'm going to run and get some extinguishers. I stayed about maybe 3 minutes. Everything was clear. I'm standing there by myself, 18 years old. I'm going, oh, my goodness, this is just not an average fire. This is a serious fire. And at that point, I made a decision at that point, because we could not shut the doors. I'm by myself. I backtracked towards the cabaret room. Checked in the Zebra to make sure in the Empire room as clear it was. Went back down the hallway towards the cabaret room and shot through a back hallway heading towards the kitchen. And headed, when we got back into the kitchen, people were evacuating. We got everyone out of the upstairs to the outside. And then there was nobody left exiting the building from the front dining room, the upstairs Crystal rooms, or the Empire room. So we took everybody through there and went out to the back garden room. And at that point, Paul Schubert came to me and said, Brock, they're dying. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, the cabaret room, they're trapped. We can't get them out. And I said, oh, my God. So we heard the fire trucks coming from the back side. So there was a picket fence that we had up there for decoration for where the, you know, weddings and stuff like that. So they came up. We pulled the fence down. The trucks came up. We walked over towards the cabaret room with the fire department. Paul Schubert was on the roof asking them to throw an axe up onto the roof so he can ventilate the cabaret room. And if he did, it would have probably saved a lot of lives. They refused to throw anything up to him. They said, get down. If you don't get down off that roof, we're going to be handcuffed when you get here. Get down. So Paul Valley got himself back down off the roof. If they would have poked holes in the ceiling of that roof, it would have saved a lot of lives. But young people make some decisions. They made a decision, and it was not the right one. And at that point, people were throwing themselves through glass windows in the garden rooms. We took our bus jackets off, put it in the fountains we had out there, and put them over top of the bodies that were burnt. A lady did live, thank goodness, but she was scarred for life. Bodies laying all over the place. It was like a war zone, to be honest with you, Chuck. I was 18 years old, and probably the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, I'm sorry to make you remember it all over again, but I know that you're really committed to getting this story out there, so I hope you feel that it's worth it to share it with our listeners.
I have fought the fight for 39 years, to tell the truth, and that's what I've done. I mean, we went to forums 3 to 4 hours. There was a book completed in 2012. We've been to NFPA in Boston, the National Fire Protection Association in Boston, went through all the files. I've been through the archives in Atlanta, Georgia. We've been through the state files of Kentucky. The 20th year anniversary, the hostess that was taking reservations that day came to me and said, "Brock, what you're doing is the right thing. Continue fighting." She goes, "I won't be alive long enough to see it done, but your truth should be told." And at that point, I told her, I said, Eileen Druckmann was her name. And I said, "Eileen, we put our life on the line that night, and that was the right thing to do." And she said, "What you're telling is the truth." She goes, "There was people working in the ceiling the day of the fire." She goes, "I told this to the state police." She goes, "I told this to everyone that interviewed me. They didn't want to hear that." She goes,
Yes. That's a great intro to our next segment. But right now we've got to finish this one.
I got an empty box.
Would you like another?
Extra big ass fries.
I said I didn't get any.
Thank you. Your account has been charged. Your balance is zero. Please
what?
Come back when you can afford to make
no,
purchase.
No, no.
Oh, I'm sorry you
come on.
I'm
starving.
Thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio. Here at Revolution Radio, we believe in freedom of ideas, freedom of speech, and above all, we believe in freedom of existence and self-reliance. This station is 100% listener-supported, and as a fundraising promotion, I have a kick-ass free gift for a $100 donation. 35,000 seeds. 25 years in the freezer. Long-term storable, 54 different varieties. So, if food prices go crazy, this hits the fan, or you just want to save tons of money every year by creating your own food like I do, grab our seed pack special. Just look for the banner on the homepage at freedomslips.com. Don't be a statistic. Don't be part of the problem.
be part of the solution. We need, as humans, to start taking care of ourselves and not depending on the megacorps to provide unhealthy, nasty food. Included in this package is also a DVD with 900 survival and offering living documents and the offline home canning how to do everything website all on the DVD. So when you're growing all that food, you know how to can it, store it, preserve it, etc. with all these documents. So thank you for tuning in to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I hope that you will pick up this package and start learning to be free. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps and freedom is one seed that needs to be planted.
What are we doing right?
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind.
Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
They're gonna stop us! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the cover you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious that you're supposed to get hard, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears, upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to integrate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You call down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
First, you tell them I'm coming, and I'm coming with me here. I'm coming with me.
Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic ride.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements, longevity, fantastic discoveries in science, download it to your brain, then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Maggie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays, 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need this, that's it. We're already here. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now, some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Barney in Bedrock, we hear. He's part of the Dirty Sitch. Hello? He's part of the Dirty System, supporting what he claims to oppose. More hypocrite than populists, turning truth on its head, claiming the Democratic Party stands with the middle class, stands with working
from Mike here. So, and now, some notes we've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From Barney and Bedrock, we hear he's part of the Dirty System, supporting what he claims to oppose, more hypocrite than populist, turning truth on its head, claiming the Democratic Sikh Party stands with the middle class, stands with working families, and is prepared to take on Wall Street and the big money interests, the same ones his voting record shows he supports while claiming otherwise. Money control, duopoly, power runs America. Democracy is pure fantasy. Republicans and Democrats are two sides of the same coin. Not a dime towards a difference separates them, waging war on humanity at home and abroad. Sanders is a con man, a despicable character, a phony populist, pro-war, pro-imperial lawlessness, pro-dirty business as usual, saying one thing, doing another throughout his 30-year career, fooling millions with empty rhetoric, promises he'd break if elected president. Clinton represents pure evil, a Wall Street profiteer's dream, a threat to world peace, supporting her shows where Sanders stands on the wrong side of issues mattering most. Asked if he'll officially endorse her before next month's Democratic convention, he always indicated yes. Without admitting it, hypocrisy defines him. And, all right, folks, I'm going to have to disconnect and reconnect and see if we can try to get everybody back online here because we don't seem to have...
Chuck, I can hear you. Hello, Chuck? Hello, Chuck?
Mike, are you back on?
Chuck? Do you hear me?
All Chuck, right, just... Well, all right. Now from Bart in Springfield. It's a scandal in contemporary international law. Don't forget that while wanton destruction of towns, cities, and villages is a war crime of long standing, the bombing of cities from airplanes goes not only unpunished but virtually unaccused. Air bombardment is state terrorism, the terrorism of the rich. It has burned up and blasted apart more innocents in the past 6 decades than have all the anti-state terrorists who ever lived. Something has benumbed our consciousness against this reality. In the United States, we would not consider for the presidency a man who had once thrown a bomb into a crowded restaurant. But we're happy to elect a man who once dropped bombs from airplanes to destroy not only restaurants, but the buildings that contained them, the neighborhoods that surrounded them. I went to Iraq after the Gulf War, saw for myself what the bombs did. Wanton destruction was just a term for it. The above was written in 1994, before the wanton destruction generated by the bombing of Yugoslavia, another in a long list of countries the United States has bombarded since the end of World War II, which is presented below. There appears to be something about launching bombs or missiles from afar into cities and people that appeals to the American military and political leaders. In part, it has to do with a conscious desire to not risk American lives in ground combat. And in part, perhaps not entirely conscious, it has to do with not wishing to look upon the gory remains of the victims, allowing American GIs and TV viewers at home to cling to their warm, fuzzy feelings about themselves, their government, and their marvelous family values. Washington officials are careful to distinguish between the explosives the U.S. drops from the sky and weapons of mass destruction, which only the officially designated enemies are depraved enough to use. The U.S. government speaks sternly of WMD, defining them as nuclear, chemical, and biological in nature, indiscriminate, meaning their use can't be limited to military objectives, as opposed to the likes of American precision cruise missiles. This is indeed a shaky semantic leg to stand on, given the well-known, extremely extensive damage to non-military targets, including numerous residences, schools, and hospitals, even from American smart bombs and almost all the bombings listed below. Moreover, Washington does not apply the term weapon of mass destruction to other weapons the U.S. regularly used, such as depleted uranium, cluster bombs, which can be and often are highly indiscriminate. WMD are sometimes further defined as those whose effects linger in the environment, causing subsequent harm to people. This would certainly apply to cluster bombs and depleted uranium weapons, the latter remaining dangerously radioactive after exploding. It would apply less to conventional bombs, but even with those, there are unexploded bombs lying around and the danger of damaged buildings later collapsing. But more importantly, it seems highly self-serving and specious, not to mention exceptionally difficult, to try to paint a human face on a Tomahawk cruise missile, whose payload of 1,000 pounds of TNT crashes into the center of a densely populated city, often with depleted uranium in its warhead. A terrorist is someone who has a bomb but doesn't have an air force. The bombing list. Korea and China, 1950-53. Guatemala, 1954. Indonesia, Cuba, Guatemala, Congo, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Guatemala, Grenada, Lebanon, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Iran, Panama, Iraq, Kuwait, Somalia, Bosnia, Sudan, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, Yemen, Iraq, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Syria. Some notes we've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. And now we're going to have the third part of the David Brock interview. All right, we're ready to resume our talk with David Brock, and he's going to pick up where he left off, telling us what's happened since the fire, why it's been so hard to get the facts. Go ahead, David.
Okay, pretty easy at this point, Chuck. You have to understand that Beverly Hills was around from 1936 to 1977. It burned down on May 28, 1977. It still sits dormant today. No one has built or has tried to build on this location of 78 acres of prime real estate in Southgate, Kentucky. There's never been a memorial built. There's absolutely been nothing up there. Everybody wants the truth to be hidden. I was told several times to keep my mouth shut by the attorney that sued and won $49 million in the case, only paid the plaintiffs $11.8 million and took $37.2 million himself. His name is Stan Chesley. He was the first one that berated me at 18 years old to keep my effing mouth shut. He made it, and I won't use the word, but you know what it means. He said, there's no money in arson, Brock. We're not going that route. We got to sue. So he sued aluminum wiring companies nationwide. You have to understand the first lawsuit against for the plaintiffs against the people they sued was found a not guilty verdict. They retried it again and won in courts in another city, in the state of Kentucky, and even a judge said, this is the most strangest case, and you're going to hear things at the final of this hearing that you've never heard in your life. But they sued aluminum wiring nationwide. All they had to prove was there was aluminum wiring in Beverly Hills, and absolutely there is. They've always, in 2007, I apologize, I was contacted by the Kentucky State Police Fire Marshal's Office to come to a convention on June the 7th of 2007. It was the 78th anniversary of a fire marshal's office in Kentucky. They already had two of my fellow employees I worked with. I already had described what I knew, but they wanted to meet me myself. So I went down to Lexington, Kentucky, and met with the fire marshal, state fire marshal named Rodney Raby at that time, a Kentucky state investigator for the police named Baez out of eastern Kentucky, and they were shocked. They could not believe there was another story to the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire. So once I told them what I knew and what I had saw with the two gentlemen that worked in the ceiling the day of the fire, Rodney Raby goes, Brock, we have a problem here. And I said, well, I don't have the problem. The problem is that people are afraid of the truth. And he goes, no, that's not the problem. He said, there is no statute of limitations on murder in the state of Kentucky. And your story needs to be told. This case needs to be re-looked into. So at that point, I was told that by a Lieutenant Crumpton, which is the media guy for the state police, that they contacted me the next day that I would be contacted by the Kentucky State Post 6, that they would interview me and get this case reopened. And he goes, you'll be contacted within 2 weeks. I contacted them myself a month later after going through Crumpton to find out who the investigator was. They met with me. It took 3 months for them finally to come to Northern Kentucky to meet with me. They met with myself and a lady by the name of Shirley Baker at La Quinta Hotel. They had 3 investigators, and they were in awe. They could not believe that there was another story to be told. They said, Mr. Brock, they cassette-taped me for over 2.5 hours, myself and Shirley. And at that time, we had no idea when we started investigating that we would be able to find the people that burnt the place down, but I found them on June the 15th, 2007. They were the ex-air conditioning company. Their company was called Rash, Savelle and Crawford out of 147 East McMicken in Cincinnati, Ohio. They were the ex-air conditioning company that the Shillings terminated 6 months prior to the place burning down. I could put them in the facility for 3 straight days that week at Beverly Hills as a burnt town. I had 12 eyewitnesses that proved that those folks were in the facility. So we went with Kentucky State Police. They were going to investigate this. They told me they would reopen it. In another 3 months, I call them back, and they kept dodging my calls because they had caller ID. They knew I was calling. I left numerous messages for Lieutenant John Bradley. He refused to take my call. So one day I hit star 69, I think is what it is, where he showed him a private number. He answered the phone. He finally took the call, and I said, I'm calling to see what you plan on doing with this. He refused. He told me, he goes, well, we 86 this. We're shorthanded in the state of Kentucky. We don't have time to look in a case that's 30 years old. And I said, at this point, I will move forward myself, and I will do this myself. I will contact the guys that burnt the building down. He thought I'd lie to him. So at that point, I got finally found where these guys lived. I located them. I called one, and the gentleman name was Halford Holloway. His first conversation with me was on a Saturday night around 9 o'clock. He proceeded to tell me that I did not want to know the truth, and I said, absolutely, I do. This history has been 30 years. It's time for the truth to be told. And his comment to me was, I can't tell you the truth. And he hung up on me. And so my nephew at 37 years old at that time goes, Dave, you're scaring me to death. I said, well, the truth needs to be told. I'm going to call him back. So I called the gentleman back and told Hal, I said, look, you think I waited 30 years for this to die? I said, no, we're not doing this. I said, first of all, I witnessed you. I said, I'm the bus boy that kept coming in that day that you ignored and kept trying to duck away from me. I said, I had no idea I would find you, but someone sent me an email to the Beverly Hills Supper Club, Quick Topic website, that your company was the one that had the issue with Beverly Hills. And I found you, and I said, you know, we need you to tell the truth. And he would not talk. He's scared to death. The other gentleman was named Arthur Reekers, out of Fort Thomas. They were partners of this air conditioning company. And there was no contractor work whatsoever that day at Beverly Hills or that week prior to the Beverly Hills Supper fire. And we continued going to the state of Kentucky. They refused to relook at the case. We went to the governor of the state of Kentucky at that time, was Stephen Brashears. We went and met with his attorneys. We 3.5 hours. Oh, my God, this is amazing. What do you want us to do? We want you to look into this. We sent 10,000 pieces of documentation to the three individuals they asked to look into this case. They held on to it for 6 months, did absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. So then the attorney general, they gave it to the attorney general, to a lady named Deidre Benthal, had no idea of the fire, which we thought would be good. She was only doing the work to cover up for the three gentlemen that did not do the work. I went down and testified for 4 hours. I took all of my documentation to prove where the fire started. I took the photos. I finally had to sue the state of Kentucky when in the federal court. And there's over 2,500 colored photos that are missing out of the Kentucky state files right now on the Beverly Hills Supper Club. They refused to put them back into the case file. They're sitting in a lab tech's home in Shelbyville, Kentucky. His name is Rodney Friels. He is retired Kentucky State Police lab tech. He's the only one that has colored photos of the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire. And I sued him. He only gave me 360 of the 2,500 slides and colored photos that they had. We only retrieved 360 of them of what they went through and gave to us that they wanted us to see. So we can prove the fire, where it started at. We can prove why. They did not want that building to burn down that night. The timing devices were set too early. They were 12 hours earlier than what they should have been. Instead of 7 o'clock at night, it was 7 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. They set up for 7 o'clock at night on Saturday. Going back to Eileen Druckmann, she goes, "You've got to go see my testimony." I gave a testimony to the state of Kentucky. So I went and did an open records request. I was harassed by the Kentucky State Police. The whole time I was there, I had three other members of our organization go down with me to review the files. The colonel of the Kentucky State Police, in the second day, comes in berating me. What nerve you had to be down here in my office taking time up. I got to pay these people to be here, and you have no right to be here doing this. This case is 30 years old, and we already done the homework on this. I said, no, you didn't. You guys did a terrible job with this case. I said, I finally got some truth and validity to this, and Eileen Druckmann's statement basically told them, and I have it on cassette tape. They asked, did we miss something? She goes, yes, those damn air conditioner guys. They were all over that place that morning. She goes, there was a tall gentleman with a sideburns, a mustache. There was another short guy, stocky. And she goes, around 2 o'clock, they went to the basement underneath the secret room. I heard a big explosion. And she goes, oh, my God, I'm going to get off the phone, because at that time, you didn't have cell phone services and stuff like that. You only had landlines. So she was taking a reservation, and she was going to hang up and call 911. She thought someone got hurt. And then it turns out these guys came running back up the steps and ran to the zebra room to see the work that they had done. And what they were doing, they were jerry-rigging the amperage and stuff like that into the breaker boxes in the basement. And by testimony, we can prove that two breaker panels were completely removed and copper leads were ran into those to make it run 100%. And that's why the air handling system continued to run when it should have shut off on the breaker panel. And that's how the fire started, in the basement directly underneath the zebra room. So they did their dirty deed that day. They did it. They finished it of work they started on Thursday that week. And they were never brought in for testimony. Can you hear me still okay, Chuck?
Yes.
This firm, there was 33 firms sued in the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire. Only one firm was released from any wrongdoing by Stan Chesley, and it was the air conditioning company of record that I'm telling you about that did the work. And it's absolutely a shame that they allow those kind of things to go on. But the Kentucky State Police still to this day has not recovered all the photos. They've not recovered anything and put back into the case file, and they've hidden basically all the evidence. Even when the NFPA came up to the location on Monday morning, 2 days, a day and a half after the fire, Richard Best, which was with NFPA, the main director, walks up to the site with 10 other people, and they were involved. They brought them in to do the proper investigation and analysis of the fire. And Richard Best asked John Conover, which was the state police guy, the main guy that's running the site, will you stop bulldozing this building because we cannot do a proper analysis of this fire if you continue to destroy the evidence? He said, do what's in front of you, and that's all you're getting. They had a bulldozer and crane on site by 11 o'clock Monday morning. And by 3 p.m. that afternoon, the three-quarters of the building was already onto the ground. The showroom, the hallway that housed the area between the zebra room and the showroom that blasted down the hallway. If they'd have left everything intact, you would have never had an issue. They could have been able to find out where the fire started. They knew the fire started in the basement. Even Governor Carroll at that time was saying that it's in the basement that the fire started. And they were looking at arson on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday morning. He comes out and says, oh, there's no fire in the basement, and arson is out. They've already had 2 days of investigation. They could not even do anything, but they already ruled arson out within 2 days. That's impossible.
That sure is. Well, we've got to wrap up at this point, but I'm sure that our listeners might be interested in reading about this, and so why don't you tell them about the book that is just out, and then we'll have to call it a night.
Well, the book itself has been out since 2012, and you can get it on Amazon. It's called The Beverly Hills Supper Club Fire, The Untold Story Behind Kentucky's Worst Tragedy. The author of it is Robert D. Webster. Myself, David Brock, as well as a gentleman named Tom McConaughey, have done all the history on it. The book itself talks about the history from 1936 all the way even to the present. And as we find new evidence and we continue to change the book for the truth to be told, everything in the book is factual. We have documented proof on everything we've got in the book.
Okay, well, thank you. And that book is also available as an e-book. Just look for it on Kindle. And David, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate you being on our show and sharing this horrendous story with us. And maybe we'll talk again.
Thank you very much, Chuck.
And once again, that was David Brock. And he was a busboy at the Beverly Hills Supper Club on the night that it burned to the ground in 1978, I think it was. He shared his story, and he pretty well proved that it's arson. And he mentioned his book, The Beverly Hills Supper Club, The Untold Story of Kentucky's Worst Tragedy. The author is Robert Webster, and David Brock is a contributing author. And it is available in paperback on Amazon and also in a Kindle edition on Amazon. And pretty reasonably priced. And I personally read this book, and I do recommend it to our listeners. That should wrap up this segment, and this segment will have
Radio, freedomslips.com. We'll be right back. The necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation. The survival of gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents. Imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank, or all the banks for that matter. Are your banking records safe in your hands? So when they get things fixed and repaired, you can say, hey, look, this is what I had. You have it. I want it back. Is your personal data safe? Family records? Addresses? Phone numbers? Well, squeeze on over to freedomslips.com. Yes, that's www.freedomslips.com. Click the banner on the homepage for the EMP-proof bullet drive to get the full scoop of everything that we offer. So, folks, keep your data safe for your peace of mind. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the host, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100%
supported
radio, and now we return
to playing just now, and we're hoping that our difficulties aren't too bad here. We're just trying to get things back going, and we're going to continue with the fourth part of the New American Dream radio show. So now, for your Thursday night American History Moment, tonight excerpts from a speech given by Howard Zinn at Binghamton University, November 2008. So, what stands in the way of Obama and the Democratic Party, and what stands in the way of them really going all out for a social and economic program that will fulfill the promise of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Well, I can think of two things that stand in the way. Maybe there are more, but I can only think of two things at a time. And, well, one of them is simply the great, powerful economic interests that don't want real economic change. Really, they don't. The powerful. I mean, you take in health care. There are powerful interests involved in the present healthcare system. People are making lots of money from the healthcare system as it is, making so much money, and that's why the cost of the healthcare system in the United States are double what healthcare costs are. The percentage, you know, of money devoted to healthcare percentage is double administrative costs in the U.S. compared to countries that have a single-payer system, because there are people there who are siphoning off this money, who are making money. You know, their health plans, their insurance companies, their health executives, CEOs, their interests, economic interests. They're in the way of real economic change. And Obama so far has not challenged those economic interests. Roosevelt did challenge those economic interests boldly, rightly, frontally. He called them economic royalists. He wasn't worried that people would say, oh, you're appealing to class conflict. You know, the kind of thing they pull out all the time, as if there isn't, hasn't always been class conflict. Just something new, you know. Class conflict. You're creating class conflict. We've never had class conflict. We've always been one happy family. There are these interests standing in the way, and unfortunately the Democratic Party is tied to many of those interests. Democratic Party is tied to a lot of corporate interests. I mean, look at the people on Obama's. The people on Obama's
economics team. They're Goldman Sachs people, former, you know, people like that, you know. They're not, they don't represent change. They represent old-style democratic stay-put leadership that's not good. So the other factor that stands in the way of a real bold economic and social program is the war. The war that has $600 billion military budget. Now, how can you call for the government to take over the healthcare system? How can you call for the government to give jobs to millions of people? How can you do all that? How can you offer free education, free higher education, which is what we should have, really? We should have free higher education. How can you double teacher salaries? How can you do all these things? Which will do away with poverty in the United States money. Well, it all costs money. Where's the money going to come from? What can come from two sources? One's the tax structure. We need a radical change in the tax structure, which will immediately free huge amounts of money to do the things that need to be done. Then we have to get some money from the military budget. How do you get money from the military budget? Don't we need $600 billion for a military budget? Don't we have to fight two wars? No. We don't have to fight any wars, you know? I think the truth is we should not be at war. We should not be at war at all. I mean, these wars are absurd. They're horrible also. They're horrible and they're absurd. The deaths and the mangled limbs and the blindness and the 3 million people in Iraq losing their homes, having to leave their homes. 3 million people, imagine, having to look elsewhere to live because of our occupation. Our war for democracy. Our war for liberty. A war for whatever it is that we're supposed to be fighting for. 100 different countries. We have military bases. That doesn't look like a peace-loving country, and it's very expensive. Do we really need those? What do we need those bases for? I can't figure out what we need those bases for. So we have to, yeah, we have to give that up, and we have to declare ourselves a peaceful nation. We will no longer be a military superpower. Oh, that's terrible. There are people who think we must be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military power at all. We can be a humanitarian superpower. We can. We'll still be powerful. We'll still be rich. But we can use that power and that wealth to help people all over the world. I mean, instead of sending helicopters to bomb people, send helicopters when they face a hurricane, an earthquake, and they desperately need helicopters. So, yeah, there's a lot of money available once you seriously, fundamentally change the foreign policy of the United States. Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. You might have seen that George H.W. Bush still lives. That old snake that we saw sneering in the back room on the night his son was dishonestly named President of the United States. The one who lied that he was out of the loop. The one who ordered the killing of thousands of people in Panama. The one who ordered the building of many new prisons to get tough on drugs and criminals in America. And it was all a scam, all to get elected, to gain power. George H.W. Bush, the one who snickered at the funeral of Gerald Ford when he mentioned from the podium the killing of John Kennedy. The one who claimed he was not in Dallas that day, that there's a photo showing that he was. The one who sits in the front row at the baseball games on national television and is applauded, not hit with tomatoes and fists and handcuffs, because he's been so successful in concealing the truth from the American people all these years. The one who said that if the American people knew what he has done, they would string him up by a light pole. Well, actually, there were some guys right here in Moon Rock Lake, some guys who suspected the truth about George H.W. Bush, who cared enough to find out the goddamn truth about our 41st president. They were not leading citizens. They did not write the editorials or sign the loans or even cut the hair of those who did. They inhabited the underground, the earth, the destitute, the hated, the laughed at, the so-called criminals themselves, and they understood. They knew where the power resided,
where the troops could be found, what the reasons were, where the bodies were buried, and they could not understand, and they wanted to find someone to ask why there might be such a stink about even talking about the killing of a rich so-called leader, and yet the real-life slaughter of thousands, millions of poor people goes by without a whisper. A passing breeze in the trees that is gone and forgotten by the time the hill fellow well-met in the cook's hat in the backyard shouts that the hot dogs are ready. And so with nothing better to do, they decided to fight. KGB, they said, kill George Bush. Some apparently recent graffiti found in D-Block. Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you, bad boys? The men of D-Block, Mark Pontiac, Bobby Ford, Stephen Baltimore, Martin Mumford, Billy Morningdog, Miguel Mendez, and Alfred Arthur. The new guy, Michael Zags, who's on his way to the jail, snatched from a downtown construction site for threatening the life of former President George H.W. Bush. The jailer is Don Burton. There's the jail, there's the outside. Some on the outside are headed to the jail. Some few realize that. Some have no idea. Unknown to the men in D-Block, an underground pirate radio station has begun operating in downtown Moonrock Lake. One woman's plan to get around the arteriosclerosis blockage of non-information provided by the regular radio station. Well, and so with nothing better to do, they decided to fight. KGB, they said, kill George Bush. These prisoners did not actually know all that George Bush had done, but they could feel it. And sometimes the heart knows what the head is yet to find out. And oftentimes, that heart beats true. On a warm Wednesday night in December 1989, Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Mahoney sat on the bench in the officer's gym at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. His team was ahead by 10 in the middle of the last quarter. He leaned back on the bench with a towel over his head, recalling the shot from the left corner. Both gym doors were propped open with cement blocks to let the night air blow through. Mahoney put the towel up over his head off his face so he could suck in the male smell of the gym. He farted and inhaled. He looked at the south door, saw a few Salvadoran soldiers hanging around, staring in. Too dark for handball, Mahoney nodded toward the door. I thought the new bug zappers were supposed to keep the beaners entertained. Hey, Jonesy, that's a good foul. They just want to kick the ball around, said the other officer. Don't know how to use their hands. Mahoney made a jerking off motion with his right hand above his crotch. As time ran out on the game, the men began to move toward the locker, taking random long-range shots. Rah! Rah! Over the speakers around the base came a foghorn sound. Rah! I can't do a foghorn. Short, insistent like a fire truck, demanding to get through city traffic. The men sprinted to the locker room, leaving basketballs scattered around the gym floor. The Salvadorans moved slowly into the gym, laughing softly. They left the lights on with sudden spangs. So they began to spread out and pass the basketballs back and forth with their feet. As the alarm sounded at Fort Bragg, and the bombers scattered at Fort Stewart in Savannah, Georgia, and the helicopter pilots aboard the carrier parked in the Gulf of Mexico hurried to the briefing room with hands full of Snicker bars, barbecue Fritos, and Coke cans. A young woman in Panama City scolded her children with a smile. Get in the house now, Miros. Andale. She's looked in the sky to see the flashes and beams of light. She clutched her chest and jerked around at the crack as her youngest son kicked a flat soccer ball perfectly into a garbage can on his way into the house.
Paolo turned to her with his hands forming goalposts in the air and beamed. She rubbed his raven head and held the door open. She turned to watch a military jeep screaming down the littered, dirty street. General Noriega had made yet another speech that day, but they had no radio. Her husband had been told to report for duty that afternoon on his day off. Inside the trailer, the five children ran down the narrow hall to their bedroom, stripped off T-shirts and jeans, and raced to the bathroom. Maria Cordova scolded them to be careful with the hot water. Don't burn yourself. Don't splash. Hey, you can't all fit in there. She brought cherry Kool-Aid and Pop-Tarts into the bathroom for the three as they sat naked on the backless bench waiting their turn. Their tangled feet played with each other like monkey tails. She knelt by the side, washing the back of three-year-old Juanita. She sang to her, De Colores, as she heard the helicopters whopping over the trailer park. De colores se visten los campos en la primavera. The little one stopped her struggling and looked up at her mother, noticing the face for the first time in her life. Juanita saw the smiling brown eyes and the swaying cascade of black hair around the pretty, perfect face. Her mother's teeth were white as milk flakes, and her lips full and generous, red as ripe coffee berries. Maria scooped up her Nita and swaddled her in a thin pink towel. Pushing her off down the hall, Maria turned to walk into the kitchen. She stopped by the small hall window. She pushed back the yellow flower curtain with a red fingernail and bent down to see into the street. Men in uniform stood in the back of a military jeep, clinging to the roll bar, searching the night sky. One shot his automatic weapon into the air, and Maria saw the flash of the gun. Then the camouflage Ford roared off down the street, disappearing in the blackness. In Washington, George Bush sat behind his mahogany desk in the Oval Office. He spoke on the phone to General Colin Powell, who stalked the war room on Sherman Hall in the north wing of the Pentagon. Bush wore a gray cardigan sweater over a white polo shirt. He listened intently and pulled on his right ear. When he spoke, his lips came to a dull point. Yes. Yes. With Powell was National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft. Scowcroft scrunched in a high-backed, deep-cushioned chair and appeared sound asleep. Powell stood and studied a detailed street map of Panama City. He and Bush had long ago decided to attack Panama in order to capture General Manuel Noriega. Powell told Bush that the CIA knew of half a dozen locations where Noriega might be found, including the Fantigo Trailer Park on West Calle Santiago, where Noriega was said to keep a shack house for personal concubines. You do what you need to do, said Bush. The American people are behind you. We salute you. We support the troops. I'm behind you. Barbara's behind you. We prayed for you and your men this evening. Vaya con Dios. May God go with you. Thank you, Mr. President. The general hung up the special mauve phone and strode from the room in battle fatigues, toothpick in his mouth. Scowcroft remained hunched in his chair, leaning on his arm. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Mahoney stood with his hand on the balance beam, night paint covering his face, his helmet tightened under his chin. The fire in his eyes meant life. Something happening. He saw the two rows of seated paratroopers silently anticipating the jump into downtown Panama City. They seemed frozen, as if their arms and legs would never move again, gone dead. But Mahoney had never felt so alive, so useful. Each brain cell and nerve in his body was on full alert, living in the moment, enjoying the day, centered, thriving on the zen energy generated by the tingle or the hum of the engine through the skin of the airplane. Mahoney again mentally checked his M16, three grenades, knife, city map, and a metal tube on his side. His unit would set down on the edge of the downtown area and come in from behind the trailer park where Noriega might be, blocking any bashful departure by him or his troops upon the arrival of the unexpected company. Noriega had known for hours the Americans were coming by monitoring the communications of the United States military compartments, and no word the past 3 days from the White House or CIA contacts, he had known and gone into hiding, leaving his undermanned troops to scan the skies with weak flashlights to highlight the bombs as they descended. In Lincoln, Nebraska, in the Havelock neighborhood, a retired gentleman sat on his couch. His wife was just returning with the popcorn as the news came on. Special report. She turned out the lamp, to make it cozy, as her husband liked it. She sat down, and he got up and returned with two red and white Budweiser cans. He popped both, gave one to her as he got comfortable. The screen was filled with the face of Dan Rather, saying that a United States invasion of Panama was in progress. Rather told about planes taking off from Fort Bragg and Fort Stewart, and that a fleet of destroyers and an aircraft carrier were in position for the assault of Panama City. The 82nd Airborne Division is right at this moment dropping into the city, Rather said. The man reached for his popcorn, keeping his eyes glued to Rather's. The woman sipped her beer. She noticed a car door slam outside. She wanted to peek out the blind, but he liked her to stay put once they cozied in for the news, not bouncing up and down like some GD jack-in-the-box. Maria Cordova went to the door to answer the banging. Her sister, who lived in a trailer down the lane, was excited and crying. She said the Americans were coming. She said she and her husband were heading to the community hall. She said they were coming to kill Panamanians. Maria comforted her sister. She told her to go to the hall if she wanted, but reminded her with a smile it was a fair distance from here and dark. Maria said she would be getting her children ready for bed. She would listen even though the military base was on the far side of the city and General Noriega had men out patrolling. She had seen them just a while ago, Maria said. It has nothing to do with us, she said. Maria's sister left. Maria watched her hurry and bare feet and disappear in the night. Maria went back into the trailer and could not find her children. Come out, wherever you are, she sang out. She stood quiet in the hall, her hands on her hips. She knew the little one would give the others away. Soon, Maria heard faint giggling. She tiptoed to follow the noise, then bent over and crept into her own bedroom, where she found five sets of eyes like a row of raccoons under her bed. She did not laugh or scold them. She got onto her stomach, stretched out her arms, and pulled them close to her. Mijos, she said, do not be afraid. And then she led them in a rapid Hail Mary, Our Father, and Glory Be. She said the Blessed Virgin would watch over them and reminded them that their father was out with the army, making sure nothing bad happens in the night. You will wake up tomorrow, and whatever's bad out there will be gone. We will play soccer, have a tortilla y quesadilla picnic. That's what Conchita was saying, that we should have a picnic tomorrow. No, Mama, said Pablo. She said the Americans are coming with guns to hurt us. We need to hide. You need to get under here. There's room. He tried to make his little voice deep. Maria brushed the back hair from his brow, pinched her lips together. Stay here, she commanded the raccoons under the bed. She hurried down the hall, peeking quickly out the window. Then moving to the door, she unhooked the latch, pushed it open a crack. She looked into the sky and saw it ablaze with exploding fireworks and arcing lights, like a farmer with a flashlight trying to find his glasses in the dark. The military jeep was back in the street with men in the back firing their weapons into the sky. Maria looked up, and in the patched light she saw that the sky was filled with bits of dry dandelion blown
by the breath of God, floating ponderously toward the guns. The men in the rear of the Jeep cursed the driver. The driver shoved the vehicle into reverse, rammed into a tree, pulled ahead, careened on two wheels down the street. The dandelion bits meandered down as Maria gasped to see the black whale swimming above in the inky ocean with fireflies punching around its wings and tail. As the white parachutes floated down around her, Maria flinched at the sounds of their weapons tinging the sides of the trailer houses. She ducked back inside, slammed the door, rushed down the hall, then turned back to close the door again. When she reached the bedroom, the back wall was in flames. Maria flung herself to the floor, reached under the bed, began pulling out hands and arms. Stay together. Hold on to each other. Is this happening to me? She thought. Am I a grown woman under the attack of men dropping from the sky, trying to save my children by myself? I can't do this. I am too small. And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream radio show. We did encounter some technical difficulties tonight, but we were able to present an excellent interview with David Brock about the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire. And thanks to my co-host Mike, we're sorry we lost him partway through and I had to finish up. Thank all of you for listening. It's the New American Dream radio show. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
People's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We can't stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious. It's the most wicked heart that you can take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your minds upon the gears, upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener support.